for the week of January 20th, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 435, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at St. James Infirmary, I'm Michael Giltz.
You're going to have to forgive me, but my English is not that good, and I'm going with infirmary has something to do with the fact that you're sick, or you were sick, you had strep throat, you have strep throat, you're taking medication for this. That must be what that's, or either that, or you're about to play a jazz song.
Well, it's a classic, blues number about the TB ward. I too have strep throat. I'm going to cough again. Sorry about that. So I am on my fifth day of penicillin. I'm short of breath, but we're going to get through the show, damn it. We missed last week. I'm going to be traveling tomorrow, I think, heading down south to Birmingham, Alabama, in warmer weather where I can recover fully. I'm feeling better. I'm not contagious anymore, but I am still got another 5 days of penicillin to get through.
Wow. Well, certainly, you know what doctors always say, take all the medication.
Well, it depends on the medication, but that's quite true for this. I am indeed supposed to take all 10 days, and I will. While we were on break, a few things happened. Remember that Olivia de Havilland lawsuit? She was suing over the TV miniseries Feud, saying they defamed her. Well, the Supreme Court failed to pick up her lawsuit, so the California ruling stands in favor of the studio. It's very hard to prove defamation when you're a public figure.
Right. So just to remind everybody what the lawsuit was over, I'm going to turn it back to Michael to remind us what the lawsuit was over.
Well, she was depicted in the miniseries Feud, having referred scathingly to her sister in the film and using a curse word. She was famously prim and proper in public. And she said that she's alive. They could have spoken to her and consulted her, and they've defamed her and her image. And basically the court said, well, yes, but not horrendously so, and you're a public figure, so sorry.
Well, another news story that we kind of mentioned previously was Actors Equity, which was kind of threatening to launch a strike over development labs. See, these are the labs where plays and musicals are kind of workshopped, so to speak, before they even go into, even off-Broadway productions.
That's right, and in fact, that strike has been launched. So that is happening. Actors Equity is officially striking over that. Some people say, producers take such risks on show. It's terrible. It's horrible. You're hobbling them. But none of these people would see a penny unless the show actually became a show, became a hit, and paid back all its investors. Then and only then would they ever see sharing in 1% of the profits. So this is way down the road and only for that rare show that becomes a hit. And they're just saying, hey, look, if we participate in the creative process to help create a show from scratch at the beginning, if it becomes that 1 in 100 big smash hit, we'd like to partake in the profits a little bit, just a little bit. And that's what they're fighting for. And I think they've got a good case and they'll probably win.
But you know what wasn't a good case was, I guess you mispronounced something so we have a bit of a correction. You mispronounced something in the obituary of lyricist Norman Gimbel.
That's right. I screwed up the name of a Jim Croce hit. It should be called I Got a Name. I called it something else. I won't repeat the mistake. But so a shame about that. So it is called I Got a Name. I played it to myself again the other day. Oh, of course it's called I Got a Name. And not only was that song coincidentally released the day after Jim Croce died, which I got right, but was also the theme song for the very good 1973 Jeff Bridges film, The Last American Hero. That's a movie about NASCAR racer Junior Johnson. So thank you to podcast listener and fellow IRA member Joe Smith for correcting me on that. The IRAs, as you may remember, is an annual voting group that I take part in, and that's going to happen in March, where we vote on the best films of the year. Been together for 40 years. I've been in there since the 90s. Very excited to take part in that, and they will keep me honest on classic American film, and that's one of Joe's favorites. I've never actually seen it, but I would like to.
And of course, if you tried to actually see it, you'd find that it's not available anywhere.
Yeah, it's one of those lost in the shuffle, one of those rare things that doesn't make the transition from 78 to LP or LP to CD. This is a movie that, for rights reasons, I guess, has just fallen through the cracks. So someday we'll get to see it again. It's a movie you always see in the credits for Jeff Bridges because it's one of his better well-known films and well-received movies. He's got many of them, but it's just one you don't get to see.
The guy won a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. So yeah, he's got a few good movies.
Free the Last American Hero. It keeps making me think of The Last American.
I know what you're thinking.
I know.
The superhero TV show. Yeah.
Yeah. Believe it or not. Totally different song. Well, okay. I'm sick. I'm going to be coughing a lot. While I'm coughing, what are we going to be talking about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're looking at hosts. So you're looking at us. Oh, wait, no. Actually, we're talking about the Emmys, which...
We should host the Oscars.
Yes. Now, the Emmys do have a host, okay? The Oscars do not, okay? No host for the Oscars still. And the Super Bowl is going to have a halftime show. Not that anyone is happy about that, or frankly, any of that. Hey, at least Kevin Hart has a hit film, which is kind of shocking given, you know, the reviews that got. Now, award season continues, but we are recording before the Oscar nominations are announced. Hey, Michael is getting over his illness, as we just mentioned, and he has to travel down south, and I have to travel this week, so you know what? Sue us, okay? We had to record on Sunday. We will take a glance at the makeup, costume, and Directors Guild's, I guess, awards, really, or are they nominations? They're picks, really. Not to mention the BAFTAs, but none of that will matter the moment the Oscar noms actually come out on Tuesday, so I hope you're listening to us soon. One result that does matter, the Producers Guild. In worldwide box office news, we've got info on Germany, and the news, like last year, is not good. In sexual misconduct news, John Lasseter thought it was time for a comeback, and most everyone else, well, they disagreed. Except for the only people that matter, his new bosses. On Inside Baseball, we'll take a look at streaming, including Netflix's price increase, and a look at their sudden eagerness to share audience data. What gives all of a sudden all this data from them? Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines, but first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We pull info from everyone else. You know the drill. The number one movie around the world is Glass, the M. Night Shyamalan film, which has turned two disparate films into a trilogy. It's magic. $90 million on its opening weekend. Its budget is reported $20 million, but let's put an asterisk by that one since it stars Bruce Willis, James McAvoy, and Samuel L. Jackson. So I'm imagining there's some writers in that one.
Yeah, I would not doubt that they have
they got a piece of the pie.
Yeah, performance bonuses, which, let's face it, are all effectively pieces of the gross.
That's okay. They made it happen, and there it is, and it's made money, and everybody's happy, even though the reviews are not that good. At number two around the world is Bumblebee. The reviews are good for this poor, hapless, trailing member of the Transformers franchise. $25 million on the weekend, $412 million worldwide. Thank you, China. So that movie is chugging along. It will end up tripling its budget just barely. But what a shame, given how much better it is than the other Transformers films, how poorly it has done.
Well, I think it just came out at the wrong time of year, but that's just me.
It seemed like a family-friendly holiday film. I don't know. Pretty good pound of programming to Mary Poppins Returns. At number three is Aquaman. $25 million on the weekend. $1,063 million worldwide. It will pass The Dark Knight Returns as Warner Brothers' highest-grossing, you know, comic book movie or movie period of all time, unless you count New Line and the Lord of the Rings movies. This is a monster of a film. The Dark Knight Returns only came out in 2012, so even adjusted for inflation, this one might even pass that one up with a few extra bucks thrown in. So this is, you know, a monster success story. God knows why.
Yeah, nobody, I mean, certainly I heard Paul DeGarabedian speak last week at the ICTA conference, and he was like, hey, you know what? Nobody expected that movie to take off the way it did. Yeah, would it be a success? Okay, sure, you know, $500, $600 million, but not over $1 billion.
So all the DC movies have been profitable. Some of them, well, maybe at least one, Wonder Woman, have gotten good reviews. This one got okay reviews, but they're all making a lot of money.
So yeah, reviews be damned. Who cares as long as they're making money?
Speaking of poor reviews, at number four is The Upside. Kevin Hart says, hey, I've got a hit. The Upside has made $17 million this weekend. It's at $50 million worldwide. It's in 44 territories. It cost about $40 million to make, so it's got to hold up for a while before it triples its budget, but it's going to get there for sure. So this is an American remake of the French film.
Les Intouchables.
Not a movie I liked. At number five around the world is Escape Room, the horror flick. What a good, low-concept, easy-to-sell idea for a horror movie. I wish I'd thought of it. You know, you get trapped in an escape room and all hell breaks loose. Oh, good idea. $14 million on the weekend, $53 million and counting.
$14.7 million.
At number six is Dragon Ball Super Broly. It's a Japanese animated film, number 21 in a franchise, $14 million on the weekend, picking up some coin in North America, $85 million worldwide. And since the whole thing probably cost less than $10 million, that is a great figure indeed. You can be sure we'll see number 22, 23, and 24. At number 7 is Bohemian Rhapsody, which keeps chugging along. It's about to pass the $800 million mark worldwide.
And guess what?
What?
Which country has Bohemian Rhapsody not been released in? It made $800 million nearly without this country.
I don't know.
China.
Oh, that's right. Well, who knows what kind of market will be there. Has it been scheduled?
I don't think so. I think that there is some cultural issues there.
There you go. At number 8 around the world is Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, the animated film that wants to take on The Incredibles and Isle of Dogs and hopefully win an Oscar. It's a big hit already, critically and commercially. $12 million on the weekend, $322 million worldwide. Right below that is Ralph Breaks the Internet, which got pretty good reviews but is struggling to triple its budget. It's at $455 million worldwide. At number 10, Mary Poppins Returns. As often happens with live-action musicals, it chugs along. $11 million on the weekend, $306 million worldwide. It's almost certainly going to triple its budget, I think, when all is said and done, and it's still got a ways to go.
I mean, even if they spent $130 million marketing this film, okay, and that means that they spent $260 all in production and marketing, well, they're going to be just fine.
Well, they'll be okay. Yeah. Won't be a big smash hit. I don't know if a sequel is a given, but I think that it's the way it's doing, and especially a boost it can perhaps hope for from the Oscars, that would certainly help give them even more incentive to greenlight a sequel. And hopefully that one will be a little more creative. At number 11 is How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World, the third and final film in a franchise. $30 million it's made worldwide. Still chugging along, still opening up in just a few small territories.
When you say third and final, let's face it. They could come back and make a fourth one, just like they're making a third Ghostbusters movie.
Well, you know, I think they craft it to be a trilogy. There's a lot of power in that. I don't know them. There could be spinoffs or whatever, but I think it's probably the end of the initial trilogy.
Okay.
Fair I guess enough. Nothing is dead, truly. But number 12 is Whitesnake, which apparently is a well-known tale, but this is a Chinese animated romance, $9 million on the weekend. It's at $23 million and counting. And number 13 is the heart-tugging, heartwarming, overly narrated, family-friendly film, A Dog's Way Home. If you love dogs, you'll love this movie.
You almost sound like you've seen the movie.
The trailer is 2.5 minutes. Literally, they might as well have shown the end credits. They told the entire film down to the final shots. It was just unbelievable. I'm like, wow, oh God. It was the worst example of telling the entire film I have seen in ages.
It's funny. I've actually sat through the trailer pack where that trailer has been in the pack, and I've actually listened to the audience say, "Well, I guess we don't need to see that now."
And yet they will.
Yeah. Well,
$10 million on the weekend, $26 million and counting. And number 14 is The Big Shot. This is a Chinese action drama about a cop standing up to a corrupt businessman who can't be touched. He'll show him. So far, it's made $40 million and counting in the Middle Kingdom. Number 15 is Mary, Queen of Scots. $6 million on the weekend. That's at $22 million worldwide. And number 16 is Creed 2, still playing in some territories. That's at $175 million worldwide. At number 17 is a Korean film. It's Malmoe, The Secret Mission. This is set in the 1940s during Japan's colonization of Korea, and scholars are fighting to keep alive the Korean language and the Korean writing system. It's made $14 million since it opened 2 weekends ago. Mortal Engines, chugging along. That's the Peter Jackson-produced film, nowhere near its reported budget of $100 to $150 million. It's made $80 million worldwide and is mostly played out. That's a real genuine flop. And number 19 is another Korean film. It's a fantasy about a bullied high school kid who swaps bodies with a gangster-turned-businessman. Hilarity ensues. $4.2 million in the weekend. That's made $10 million worldwide since it opened presumably last week. And finally, the favorite, a Oscar hopeful, which I hope does get lots of Oscar nominations. I'm sure it will. $4 million on the weekend. That's at $42 million worldwide.
It's a good movie, The Favorite.
It's a very good movie. And speaking of China, Deadpool 2, the PG-13 version, that is, Once Upon a Deadpool, that's got a release date in China. Maybe that was the reason all along. Comes out January 25th. We'll have to see how it does.
Now, did Deadpool 2 open in China, the original? No, it did not.
No, because it's too violent.
Well, then there you go.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me about Germany. We did get some figures from the German box office. It was not, it was good news last year, actually, modestly good news. So, but it's been 3 years in a row now. The overall picture is not great.
Yeah, so the last 3 years, the German box office has been down 17%, up 6%, and then down 16%. And it fell, I guess what, it's 16% this year. So 2018, right. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's not good. It's the world's eighth biggest movie-going market. And the box, the drop in box office tracks very nicely with a drop in admissions. Admissions fell 15%. The total box office is just under $1 billion U.S. Also not good news. There were no German films in the top 10. You never like to see that. You want to see a healthy local market. Hollywood, of course, accounts for the vast majority of the box office, 75%. So not great news for Germany at all. Down 17% and then up 6% from that fall and then down another 16%. That is really not a good trend over 3 years.
Yeah, I mean, you're basically down, when you think about it, 27%.
And what, well, I mean,
from,
you know.
From 3 years ago. Yeah, from the, yeah.
Well, you can't just add it up. I mean, you know, because you're down. You're already, I mean, it depends on where you start. So
that's true. But then I was never very good at math. So, you know.
Yeah, that's not how that works. You don't just add up. But anyway, not good news. But what always goes up is studio pay, right? If you're at the top of the heap, money always seems to go up. Your film, your studio does terrible, they fire you and give you lots of money. Your studio does great, they keep you on and give you lots of money.
And if your studio is doing really, really well, as in like historically well, as in record breaking well, as in like $3-4 billion in a year box office well, you try to leave, but then you keep buying other companies, and the board insists that you stay, and then decides to pay you $65 million to keep you. And that's exactly what happened to Bob Iger over at Disney. He earned $65 million last year.
Clearly, he has no interest in leaving.
You know, he did, but I think he clearly understands that he had to stay after purchasing Fox. And in fact, there's the story of how he gathered his family around and they were all like, oh God, he's going to run for president. He's going to he's going to approach us and ask us, you know, to give us his blessing, our blessing to for him to run for president. And we really don't want to have to deal with that. And then he said, I'm going to... we're going to buy Fox over at Disney, and I'm going to stay on for a couple more years to oversee the transition and the integration. And they were like, oh, thank God. Thank God he's not running for president.
Well, I agree with that.
It's like, oh, good. He's just going to keep working at Disney. Okay, thank God.
Well, anyway, so Bob Iger, he's the first that we've heard of this season. I'm sure lots more info will come out about other top execs in the entertainment business and how much crazy, funny money they are being paid. But it's awards season.
That's right.
The BAFTA nominations were fascinating. One UK film did not get picked for the big top nominee, Bohemian Rhapsody. Why would they not highlight that film?
I think maybe because of the controversy with Bryan Singer. I don't know.
No,
or maybe it's the kind of thing where everybody thought, well, everybody's going to vote for Bohemian Rhapsody. You know what? I'm going to make my vote count. I'm going to give it to somebody else. And then in the end, nobody voted for Bohemian Rhapsody, thinking that everybody else would vote for Bohemian Rhapsody.
I guess so. But the big nominees for the top award are Black Klansman, Green Book, The Favorite, Roma, and A Star Is Born. Many of the usual suspects, but you certainly would have expected to see Bohemian Rhapsody in the mix, and it didn't make the cut. Is that telling? I don't know. I don't think so. Who knows?
Well, certainly over at the Directors Guild, they weighed in with their five nominees, and we have, again, an absence of Bohemian Rhapsody, maybe because there is all that controversy around Bryan Singer. You have Black Klansman, Green Book, Roma, A Star Is Born, and Vice. It's the first nomination for Spike Lee and Bradley Cooper and Peter Farrelly.
First nomination for Spike Lee. Racist much, DGA? Good God.
Well, remember, he famously said, I will never be a member of the DGA. There was like a big beef between him and the DGA, so they kind of purposefully avoided him.
Because they were hateful.
Not The Hateful Eight, though, which was a Quentin Tarantino
movie. Don't put it on him.
No, I'm just saying that there was, there was an infamous beef between that guild and Spike Lee. He spoke ill of them, and so
probably necessarily. When did he become a member?
I don't know, actually. That's a good question. He might still not be a member.
Well, they wouldn't vote for you if you're not a member.
No, maybe not.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you got to be part of the WGA. You got to be part of the DGA. You got to be part of, you know.
Yeah, I don't know, actually. That's a good question. I will look that up.
All right, you do that while I keep talking. We've got some guild nominations, but I want to point out how they are not players in the Oscar race. The costume designers made their nominees announced. They have three top categories, all very reasonable: contemporary, period, and sci-fi fantasy. The makeup artists and hairstylists also have their nominees, also very reasonably broken up into multiple categories: best contemporary, best period and character, which seems to include fantasy, and best special effect makeup. Now, I think if these people want to be players, they really need to have a super category of best overall, where they cut to the quick and say, all right, what are your 5 or 10 best nominees? Because when you've got 15 nominees, you're basically just throwing your hat in the air and say, yeah, all of them. So it's really hard for people to get a trend or any indication from you on what you value the most in the costume world when you name 15 films. It just doesn't help people. So I think they really should have a super category in which they say, all right, these, it makes sense to break them up by area because they're very different challenges. But ultimately, you want to be a player, name your 5 best costumed films of the year.
I can't find out when Spike Lee became a member of the DGA, but there was an infamous, you know, I guess they snubbed Do the Right Thing.
Well, there you go. Well, Green Book seems to, you know, Spike Lee is now playing by the rules. Green Book, however, seems determined not to win an Oscar. The last 2 weeks, everything they've done has just, they have stumbled again and again. First, of course, Viggo Mortensen with the N-word. When he was denouncing the N-word, he used it. That didn't go over well. Then the family of the jazz pianist who is portrayed in the film say their father refused to greenlight a script by the son of his chauffeur. They say they were ignored once their father died and the project went forward. They said they had no idea it was even being made and that the portrayal of their father and the chauffeur as friends is absurd. Now, the son who wrote the screenplay has had to apologize for spreading his racist anti-Muslim lie that Muslims danced in New Jersey and cheered on 9/11 and was all broadcast on TV, which is an effing lie and absurd and racist of him to say so, but they didn't. It didn't happen. It wasn't aired on TV, and now he feels terrible. He's deleted his Twitter account. He's apologized especially to star Mahershala Ali, who is Muslim, and everybody feels bad. And yet,
Green Book actually won the top prize at the PGA Awards, the Producers Guild Awards. Now, why is that important? That is important because the producers vote in the
Oscars. Guild. It's a guild. It's a guild.
Yeah, it's a guild. So,
It's also, now people immediately said, oh, they're the front runner. On the other hand, they're not even nominated for a SAG Award, which is the biggest guild. So, you know, they have momentum, that helps, but next week someone else is going to get momentum when the SAG vote for them. And the week after that, it could be somebody else when the DGA votes for them. So, yes, this is a huge win for Green Book. We'll have to see where it ends up. It certainly doesn't hurt. But my goodness, what a confusing, wide open year. It could be anything. I really think this is one of the most wide open years in ages. I don't think any movie's got this locked up. A Star is Born, Bohemian Rhapsody, Roma, Green Book, Black Panther. I have no idea. I don't think anybody does. But we know Green Book won the PGA Award, and we know that they also gave Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse their Best Animated Film Award, and the
documentary.
Won't You Be My Neighbor, that one Best Doc.
Yeah, and I think it's between that and the Ruth Bader Ginsburg doc, don't you think?
I would imagine, but doc is always a tricky little area where you got to watch all 5. So I think now you're on the honor system. But certainly it was a hugely popular and sentimental favorite. They both made tons of money. So did Fill the Void, Free the Void. What's it called?
Touching the Void?
No, not Touching the Void.
Top of the Void? That. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
The mountain climbing one, you know? I mean, we don't even know what the nominees are yet, so we'll find out on Tuesday. But yeah, boy, why? I don't think that's a lock by any stretch of the imagination, because you can always get a wild card in the documentary area. But Green Book won the Producers Guild for Best Film of the Year. Didn't see that coming.
I believe it's called Free Solo, the name of the movie that you're talking about. Which, by the way, I can understand why you would say Touching the Void, because it looks exactly the same. It looks like the exact same movie. And I'm sure it's not. Right?
Well, we found out that the Grammys will be hosted by Alicia Keys, who's won over a dozen Grammys, so that makes sense. But there is no host for the Oscars. Kevin Hart has a hit film, but he is not doing the Oscars. Don't even ask him. ABC is now just trying to get a lineup of all stars. They want to get as many of the Marvel superheroes on stage as they can. They're going to have rotating stars. It didn't work the last time they did this, where they had just rotating stars. We'll have to see what happens
when
now.
When was the last time they did this?
It wasn't that long ago. It was in the last decade, I believe, where they ended up thinking having a no host was a good idea, or they did it out of desperation. I still say for next year, they should start working on the Muppets right now with Jason Segel, too. Why not?
Yeah, he could actually be a pretty good host, I bet.
Well, with the Muppets, you know.
Yeah.
Him and the Muppets. They made the movie together, did a great job. I think they'd be great hosts, frankly, for several years running. You know, I'd love to have the Muppets host the Oscars. It's a great tie-in. It's Disney and ABC. They can make it happen. You know, why not? Start planning it now. For God's sake. Save us all.
You know, I was, I fell into a YouTube hole. You know when that happens? You kind of just look up one thing on YouTube, and the next thing you know, it's 4 hours later, and you've watched, you know, countless ridiculous things that you never planned on watching. Well, somehow, I wound up watching Billy Crystal's opening monologue to the 1993 Oscars, which was about 14 minutes long, and I don't know why they served this up to me, but they did. And it was just, I thought, wow, that was like, you know, A Few Good Men was nominated, and there was Jack Nicholson in the front row. It was kind of, it was a blast from the past.
Mm-hmm.
You don't care. Okay, never mind.
Was your thought how great he was, and we haven't had a host that good since, or?
Yeah, I did think, wow, he really was pretty good at this whole thing.
It's not an easy gig. And neither is the halftime show, but it's supposed to be a plum gig, a gig you're excited by. The Super Bowl does have a halftime show, but everybody seems embarrassed about it. Maroon 5 is going to be officially joined by Travis Scott, who's certainly a red-hot talent, and Big Boy of Outkast, who is an Atlanta native. They're all going to be performing at the Super Bowl. They also, uncoincidentally, share a management company.
So well, why doesn't all of Outkast show up? You got Big Boy, but why not, Andre 3000, right? I mean, would be
he didn't want any part of it.
Is it Andre 3000? Now
they would have loved. Like they would have loved. They would have loved an Outkast reunion. Hasn't happened in a number of years, but he wanted no part of it, from what I understand.
It's, by the way, I'm sure it's Andre. No, it is Andre 3000. Thank goodness.
Well, Travis Scott, even before they announced he'd be doing the halftime show, he announced preemptively a $500,000 donation being made in concert with the NFL to an important charity, just to be clear that he got some money from them and to sort of preemptively cover his tracks for taking part in the halftime show. A member of Maroon 5 was defending their taking part in the halftime. I mean, you're supposed to be celebrating when you do the halftime show, not defending it. So that's kind of amazing and tells you how far and hard it has fallen. Next year's going to be a real disaster. And even Gladys Knight, she's doing the national anthem, and she had a very defensive, confused statement saying, I'm doing the national anthem. Don't tell me I can't. And I heard about Colin, and he's talking about police brutality, and that's got nothing to do with the anthem. So it shouldn't have anything to do with it. So I'm bringing us all back together. So shut up and let me sing.
I mean, it was. Give me this microphone. Out of my way.
Not a good idea. So I don't think she should have done it. I don't think any of them should have done it. I think it's a disaster that you're announcing you're taking part in the Super Bowl halftime show and you're trying to cover your tracks while doing it. Oh, this is just awful.
Well, speaking of disasters, it's time for our sexual misconduct news, which...
Yay!
Yeah. And that's, by the way, a sarcastic, ironic yay, by the way. And this week, we teased it at the head of the show. John Lasseter of Pixar fame, he is back. This time, he was tapped to head Skydance over at Paramount.
Well, not technically Paramount. Paramount distributes it, I should say. They had no involvement in his picking. It was a surprise to them, and they were none too pleased. So John Lasseter has been named the head of Skydance. They have two films in the works. I believe both of them are directed by women. Certainly at least one of them is, or maybe there are two women working on the one film. But that's a little ironic. Basically, Skydance tried to cover their tracks. They reached out to Time's Up, the women's rights group, and they said, tell us, when is someone ready for a comeback? What should you look for? And they finally figured out what they were doing. Like, look, we're not giving you cover for this. And when they Skydance announced it, they condemned it. Most people seem to be condemning it and very upset about it. The people at Skydance were upset. The people at Paramount were upset. The people in groups fighting for, you know, equal rights for women in the workplace are upset. The only people who aren't upset are his new bosses at Skydance. People say, well, when does he get to come back? What does he have to do? When does he get to come back? And I have to immediately think about, what about all the women whose careers he destroyed and derailed? When do they get to come back?
Now, did he – now, certainly, I know, you know, this whole sexual harassment thing. People's careers were destroyed. Did he destroy careers, or I don't know whether John Lasseter did. I'm not saying that he didn't.
Of course we know John Lasseter did, because they had the Lasseter movie. Sexually harassed women talked about leaving their job, quitting their careers.
Oh, well, then,
because
yeah,
they
okay.
couldn't
then,
handle
yeah,
the humiliation and embarrassment of John Lasseter diminishing their work. We have no idea of the extent and level of careers that were destroyed, not because he said, I am destroying your career, but because he diminished, humiliated, and mocked and belittled women and treated them as sexual objects.
And so they just
said,
okay,
adding it all up. We have no way of – he didn't say, I am targeting you and destroying your career. No, he just made it a miserable workplace for women who quit the industry altogether or went somewhere else and started from scratch, you know, a few rungs lower than they should have. Women who should have been championed and raised up felt themselves pushed down and aside. So, yes, he absolutely destroyed careers.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I didn't know that.
Of course do that. That's talked about at the time. Many women came forward talking about it. Women who left the industry for good. When you're talking about someone who has a nickname after him, the Lasseter, because he's so sexually harassing and groping at meetings, how humiliating is that? You have to be able to understand that that means, guess what? That has an impact.
You know, can I just say in my defense, how sad is it that we have so many of these cases that I can't even remember which one where, you know, somebody said, oh, well, this person made a pass at me, or this person actually, you know, quit. And you know, I can't even keep them straight to know which – I mean, they're all bad, but right. I can't keep them straight.
Well, you don't have to give a list of all the women who came publicly forward. You just have to know that 10 or 20 years of him behaving like a drunken lout and creating an atmosphere where women felt sexually harassed, demeaned, and diminished is going to have an impact. And so people keep wondering, well, when does he get to come back? What about all the women who never get to come back? And what did he do now? All he did was spend a year and a half lying low, and now he's accepted a new job. He had the most milquetoast comment possible, which was basically, well, apparently I've, you know, unintentionally offended people, and for that I apologize. You know, you didn't unintentionally offend them when you were sexually groping them, forcibly kissing them, grabbing them in staff meetings. You know, that's not unintentional, and that just shows a complete lack of remorse. He hasn't shown any public steps of taking responsibility for what he did. He's shown no remorse. He has taken no action to try and rehabilitate his image, like working with rights groups to show he wants to make amends, you know, like women's rights groups or Time's Up or anybody else. He hasn't done any of the work publicly that you should have to do first before you get to have a new career again.
Do you think that R. Kelly will ever have a new career again? He was just dumped by his label, RCA.
Well, you know, his career has been peaked like 20 years ago. So let's be clear about that. His last hits were about 6 or 7 years ago, which is a lifetime. And those were with bigger artists, Lady Gaga and Justin Bieber. He was sort of a presence on some of their hits in 2013. His last solo R&B top 10 hit was way back in 2011. He had a fluke video hit with Trapped in the Closet. But his heyday was really 2 decades ago. So is he going to come back? No. But a TV documentary, Surviving R. Kelly, was the final nail in the coffin, showing the horrific behavior he is engaged in for decades, helped in part by everybody around him. Finally, RCA has dumped him. Universal Music Publishing says they dumped him months ago, though I still believe they represent his music catalog. Time's Up has called on Apple, Spotify, and others to stop promoting his music. Lady Gaga has pulled a song that they did together. You know, I feel like trying to erase people from history is creepy.
You know what's really interesting is
it doesn't exist.
Yeah, ironically, as much as I didn't know about John Lasseter, here, R. Kelly, okay, I would tell you that, you know, he was a running joke. Like the fact that he, you know, all of that behavior, how was that a surprise to anybody?
Well, it's not. But, you know, you have to, it reaches a tipping point.
Well, this was a tipping point.
You finally realize it's been going on and on and on and on and on. And more women get the courage to come forward and finally. You know, like with Bill Cosby, you know, the needle drops, something happens, and suddenly he starts to pay a price. It's a long after he was a huge commercial force. But again, I'm not much for erasing names from history and trying to pretend his music never existed. I don't see the point in that. If I was Lady Gaga, I'd say, I'm going to donate any money from that single that I did with him to a women's rights group, to a charity, or violence against women, or sexual abuse against minors, something like that, rather than trying to pretend it never happened. I don't like that. I still listen to Michael Jackson music. I still listen to other people's music. I'm not a big R. Kelly fan, but I don't think, you know, shutting our eyes and saying, you know, I believe I can fly never happened really serves any purpose at all.
Well, this whole R. Kelly thing seems to have left you breathless, although that could be the strep throat. And that kind of, you know, let's face it, R. Kelly's career, as we think it's pretty much all wrapped up at this point, kind of like our sexual misconduct segment, and moves us along. That moves us along into Big Deal or Big Whoop. Now, Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story: if you're an Emmy voter, say goodbye to the flood of DVDs that swamp you every year. The expense has grown too big and the environmental impact too huge to ignore. Besides, most of the shows can be accessed via streaming, so after 2019, the Emmys are saying no physical screeners. None. Zero. Zip. Nada. Niet. I could keep going, but, you know, you get it. It saves money, saves the environment, and reflects the way most people catch up on TV already, via on demand. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. Of course, it's a short-term big deal. I'm wondering how long will people have access to those TV shows? They should kind of make it year-round, frankly, because they'll have, like, the Academy app and website where you can access TV shows. And they frankly should make them available to Emmy voters year-round so that if they want to catch up on The American season one, they shouldn't lock it off after the end of the Emmy voting. They should say, hey, you know, you want to watch it for season two and season three and season four. So leave it all available. That's what I say. And there's still going to be some older voters who are saying, where's the Geek Squad? I do not know how to stream stuff.
That's true. Now, here's my question. Why mess with this success? And that isn't about DVDs, okay? It's about NBC, because on NBC's morning news show today, the 9 a.m. slot was a winner with Al Roker and Tamron Hall. Heck, the entire four-hour block was a success. Then NBC decided to plunk down conservative talk show host Megyn Kelly right into the middle of the Comfy franchise, upending basically, well, let's just say everything, okay? At the same time, Matt Lauer was ousted for his sexual misconduct over many years after a 20-year stint as co-host of the key 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. slot. So no wonder NBC has come to its senses and asked weatherman Al Roker to please, please, please return to hosting the 9 a.m. show. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, right? I mean, if they didn't do it, you'd just knock your head and go, what in God's name are they thinking? I mean, we would have done a better job at 9 a.m. than Megyn Kelly.
Yeah, well.
No?
Yeah,
yes, we would have.
Yeah, would have been a disaster. I think that's true of no matter who you put in that slot.
We would have been a disaster, but we would have been better and cheaper. So, yes, Al Roker, thank God. What else were they going to do? But, I mean, Hoda, boy, is she working hard.
Well, apparently giving away your video games for free is a great way to make a lot of money. Fortnite is the big beast we're talking about here, but 9 of the top 10 free-to-play video games generated $1 billion or more, and number 10 made $900 million. So we're talking about, what, nearly $9.9 billion. That's unbelievable.
No, more than that. That's not $1 billion each.
Oh, I
thought $1 billion or more. No, don't, you can't do it like that.
You know what? This is why I tell you, Michael, if you really want, I will do your taxes for free. Okay.
Your kids are going to do so bad on the SATs.
All I can say is you are, if I do your taxes, you will be audited. But that's.
Yeah. So why are they generating money? If they're free, where's the money coming from?
Well, all of it was generated by people paying extra money for, like, dance moves and new outfits and other swag. At the top is Fortnite, of course, with $2.4 billion. At number two is Dungeon Fighter Online from Nexon with $1.5 billion. Then there's League of Legends Riot Games with $1.4 billion. Well, it's Riot Games, League of Legends, really. $1.4 billion. And then the next three with $1.3 billion, including Honor of Kings, Crossfire, and Pokemon Go. I didn't even know Pokemon Go was still a thing. Okay. Big deal or big whoop?
$1.3 billion. That's how much Pokemon Go made this year. They had a nice little refresh. So, I mean, good God, though. Fortnite made $2.4 billion in 1 year alone just from extras. You can play the game for free. That is mind-blowing. $2.4 billion is a lot of money. I would love to see a full listing of everything, whether you sold cartridges or you're free to play and you just sold extras. I'd love to see a full rendering of all the video game world, because boy, there's a lot of money there.
Well, I get all my video games on 8-track tape. That is how that, oh wait, no, that's music, isn't it? Anyway, I don't know that because I'm too busy eating at Nate and Al's. You know, that's how old I am.
Have you ever?
My God. I had a job interview in there that went so south, I accidentally spilled an entire glass of orange juice on the person that was interviewing me. It was horrible.
Did you get the job?
No, I did not.
Where was it at?
It was at Paradigm Talent Agency.
And no.
Yeah, I was like, okay, so I'm not hired, right? It's just like, how expensive was it? Oh, that was an expensive suit. Okay. And note, I used the past tense.
So why are we talking about Nate and Al's?
Well, living in LA has its ups and downs, like when you spill orange juice on your interviewer. But oy, without the 73-year-old Jewish deli known as Nate and Al's in Beverly Hills, it would be unthinkable. Unfortunately, the land on which Nate now sits is hugely valuable. It's like right there on Beverly Drive. And the current owners were looking to sell. Can't imagine why. Gee, could they be like 95 years old? Luckily, music mogul Irving Azoff, Cindy Crawford, and others banded together to buy the business and move it to a new location nearby, currently occupied by a Wolfgang Puck's, in fact. Rumors of a move to Brentwood, which would have been in a Shonda, I tell you, that happily seemed to be just that, just rumors. Big deal or big whoop?
You tell me.
You know, look, big institutions like Nate and Al's, they open and close all the time in Los Angeles. You know, Chasen's was the big guy.
They've been there for 73 years.
Yeah, and Chasen's was there for as many years as, and that closed down and became a Bristol Farms, you know, so a grocery store. So, you know, I think everybody assumed, well, at some point, Nate and Al's would go out of business or the people who owned it wouldn't want to run it anymore. And I'm glad to see that people felt like, you know what? Let's buy it. If it breaks even, we'll be happy. And let's move it to maybe a less expensive location, which is probably needed to happen.
You feel like it's close enough that it'll survive and keep its character?
I certainly hope it does. It's like a stepping back into the 50s or 60s when you walk in there. And I will tell you, the last time I was there, I actually, I was already seated. This person came and sat down next to me. His name was Rupert Murdoch. And I was
That's
just
it?
Yeah, well, yeah, I don't know. Okay. Multi-billionaire, and he's sitting next to me at the deli.
Well, sadly, the story of our time is that if you love something, it will die unless, of course, a billionaire adopts it.
Well, that's true. Now, speaking of things that have been around for a while, after 40 years and an indelible connection with the Olympics, sports broadcaster Bob Costas is finally leaving NBC. Or as Costas probably felt, he finally admitted that NBC had long ago left him. The multi-talented announcer, comfortable covering all sorts of sporting events, says NBC slowly back away from all of them. The World Series, baseball in general, and pretty much every other sport you can name. NBC was once wedded to sports, and now it just doesn't do them. So Costas decided 12 Olympics were enough. Costas realized there was literally nothing for him to do at NBC, and they parted ways. His final modest act as a broadcaster, whatever it might be, would happen somewhere else. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, but it's a little sad. I mean, NBC just doesn't do any sports. For years, you've been looking at poor Bob Costas trapped at the one network that has, like, no sports. None. Except once every 2 or 4 years, they do an Olympics. So it's a bummer that after 40 years with NBC, he has to go somewhere else just to finish up his career, but that's where we're at.
The drama bookshop, we talked about it. It has been saved. Though the beloved theater district hangout closed on January 20th due to an explosive increase in rent, so it closed today, a coalition has come together to make sure it will continue. Led by Lin-Manuel Miranda and director Thomas Kail, the group includes top theater owners and a determination by the city to make sure they can find a new space, buy it forever, and make certain the drama bookshop will have a permanent home and performance space with rehearsal options. Hey, anyone want to adopt a podcast? Because we could use that. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, right? I mean, it's just like our story above about Nate and Al's. Okay, you know, some wealthy people decided to keep it going. God bless them. But, you know, charity is not going to get our economy and our world back on its feet.
No. Now, a story in music business world highlighted the problem of policing the music placed on streaming services like Spotify, especially when those platforms are opening themselves up to independent acts who want to put out an album on their own. That helps explain why Beyoncé dropped not one but two albums over the holidays. Yes, Bey was very busy, or at least fans of hers were. Under the name Queen Carter, two albums of music were released. Fans soon heard the rumor they were by the Queen of Pop, and they went to check them out. Turns out the quote-unquote albums contained old demos and previously released tracks and were taken down within a day. The same thing happened to SZA, just a stunt by ardent fans or a way to profit in a roundabout way from a superstar's talent. Kind of a shame. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. It seems like the system is working, you know? They got taken down in a day. It didn't last long. However, there's some really tricky thing where these Bulgarian pirates were ID'd in February of 2018. They were setting up streaming farms, and they would put up fake music, create a couple hundred thousand fake Spotify accounts, and then play those fake music on a loop. And the result was that they would generate more than $1 million in royalties before the scam was identified. So that's kind of awesome and amazing. Once you set up a system this big, people will try to figure out a way to rip it off.
Well, actually, since we're talking about streaming, why don't we move along into Inside Baseball, since that's our subject for that segment. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, as I just mentioned, we're going to talk about streaming, because what else is there in this business but streaming? Heck, even the Emmys are doing it. Everything is being upended by streaming, and we'll discuss the latest, including a price increase by Netflix, their newfound interest in sharing audience ratings, Hulu's jump in subscribers, and advertising, and finally, the long tail in music streaming. And, you know, I think Trevor Noah made the joke of if, you know, he's going to have to find more people to share and split his Netflix account with now that they're kind of boosting the price of a Netflix account to $13 a month.
That's in North America, or the United States, I should say, for their most popular plan. It jumps to $13. There are also hikes in a lot of Latin territories where people pay in U.S. dollars, though not the two biggest territories, Mexico and Brazil. As an update, there are 59 million subscribers in the United States and 139 million subscribers worldwide. So this is their first rent increase for the United States in 2 years. Do you think it'll matter? I certainly don't. I don't think it's even close.
No, I think what they need is popular hit shows and movies, and they've got them.
Right. I think they would. I think, you know, $15 might be a price point. Certainly when they get to 20, 5 or 8 years from now, that will be a price point that going above that will really be an inflection point. That will hit them hard. I think that's where you start to say, wow, you know, you might want to slow down a bit. Maybe you should just spend a couple less billion on marketing and budgets, you know? So right now they're spending like crazy. I think anywhere below $20, I think in the United States is a very safe price point. They've proven good value, and I think they're going to be okay.
Well, you know, actually, they got some free PR over the past couple of weeks due to the movie Bird Box, and they've got some negative PR about, you know, clips that were, you know, featured in the film being, you know, I guess clips from actual disasters. But most of it was about how much people watch this movie, or how many people watch this movie, because it is a hit. Netflix said so, and now Nielsen, the I guess group that kind of monitors this kind of thing along with Comscore, they agree. Netflix gave a worldwide totals for this suspense film, insisting it was watched by 45 million accounts around the world.
Cool. Well, that was like 2 weeks ago.
Right. We talked about it. They only counted an account, by the way, if it watched at least 70% of the film. Now Nielsen has weighed in, touting its SVOD content ratings. That's their product. Nielsen says in the U.S., it estimates the movie was watched by more than 25 million viewers. The movie started slower than Will Smith's Bright, which was also on Netflix, but word of mouth was great and viewership held steady throughout the holidays. Of all the originals it has measured, only season 2 of Stranger Things did better in its first week. And after 10 days, Nielsen estimates Bird Box has been seen by 40 million people in the U.S. alone. Almost 60% of them were women, and almost half were people of color.
So basically, this is Netflix touting their new metric for measuring streaming video on demand. They're saying, hey, we can capture this audience and do a good job of it.
Right.
Right. And the interesting thing I think is I like the metric of 70%. If you didn't watch 70% of the movie, you haven't watched the movie. I think that's a very strong measure. That's not 51% or 62%. You know, I think 70% is a very, very strong measurement. That's a real, you know, flag, you know, in the ground. That's a measurement I can live with and feel like that's very valid. If you've watched over 70% of the film, you basically watch the film and you probably will finish and watch the rest. So I like that metric and I'm glad Netflix told us that. They've now updated their figures. They now say Bird Box has been watched by at least 80 million households. At least 80 million households have watched at least 70% of the film. That's how they measure and say, okay, you watched the movie. You watched over almost 2/3 of it. They also gave some other info. Suddenly they're all chatty Cathys. You know that TV series You, it's about a man stalking a woman, was on Lifetime, and there it only averaged about 1 million viewers per episode. Netflix now says it's exploded. 40 million households have watched at least one episode of that series. So it's getting a lot of sampling. They have a Spanish, they have a new show called Sex Education. They say that's been sampled by 40 million households. That means at least one episode was watched. Most of the episode. And finally, they have a Spanish high school drama called Elite, and they say 20 million households have watched at least most of one episode. So now Bird Box is a movie. I get that comparison of 70%, but you got a TV show? All right, you can say people sampled the show, but if you want to tell me something I really want to know, tell me that they've watched 70% of the episodes or 70% of the content. Then you'll be telling me something about
you. Or watched
the
second episode or watched, you know, if it's 11 episodes, right. tell me if they got to episode 9.
So here's my big question, though, beyond the fact that that's not very good information, that's just telling us, okay, they glanced at an episode. I want to know, why is Netflix suddenly getting all chatty about its metrics? It never wanted to share audience measurements. Now suddenly it can't shut up.
Well, okay, there's a couple of reasons why. One, they're plateauing, so we all know that. And they, you know, so they're doing that for the street, okay, for Wall Street. That's number one. The revenue has kind of plateaued. That's why they're raising prices. And so they're looking to gin up some positive news for Wall Street. At the same time, they're realizing, hey, you know what? When we kind of mention these numbers, hey, people write about us nonstop. And it's like free publicity. Yeah, no kidding. That's why we all talk about box office. You know, they don't want to, you know, mention their box office figures for films that they release into theaters day and date with release on Netflix. Okay, fine, we get it. You're only releasing in 5, 6, 7 screens. You don't want to kind of point to a figure that might not be so good. At least it might not be the tens of millions of dollars that the hit film made that week. Sure. Okay, great. But this actually gets more people watching. And they're also finally signaling to talent, hey, yes, you can go to Amazon, and soon you'll be able to go to Apple, and certainly Hulu's around. And CBS is doing their own thing. And there's all these other places for you to go to. But if you want tens of millions of people watching your content, guess what? Come to Netflix. We've got them.
And now that they've opened the door, every time they don't share some data, you're going to be suspicious, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. And that is likely why they did not want to start that. They didn't want to open up that Pandora's box. They kind of had to at some point, because others were going to start saying, hey, you know, Hulu would turn around and say, hey, 30 million people watched, what was the name of that?
They're not wildly forthcoming either, and they don't have that many shows to tout.
Right.
But they do have some good news. Hulu has hit 25 million subscribers. They also grossed $1.5 billion in advertising last year. So they're up 50% almost from 1 year ago in number of subscribers, and they're up almost 45%. And ad sales. So that's pretty damn good. And all those figures include streamers plus those who have bought a TV channel bundle. Every possible subscriber they have, they've hit 25 million, and their advertising is growing explosively. So that's all good news for Hulu.
Well, you know, I would go on and talk about streaming music just because, you know, it's the one thing we haven't talked about, but you literally seem like you're totally out of breath. I mean, this news just winded you. So really, I'm just glad that you're still, you know, with us to do the show. Unlike some people like Mark Ehrman,
Oh, that's a terrible, terrible segue.
Don't make light of me being dead.
People have died. It's okay. You do not have to make a segue. We're now in the obituary section, and some people have died. Did you know Mark Erman? He worked in PR first, and he's an indie executive. He died at 66, rather young. He worked at Lionsgate and Think Film. He worked on some terrific movies like Half Nelson with Ryan Gosling, an early key film for him. Gods and Monsters, who is a film by a former IRA member, I should say. And Monsters Ball, an Oscar winner for Halle Berry. And also he worked on the Oscar winner Taxi to the Dark Side. And one of my favorite documentaries, The Aristocrats. That's a filthy, filthy film. So an interesting career from publicist to studio exec from Mark Erman. Did you know him?
I did, actually. Not, you know, not well.
Right.
And I knew mostly through Think Film.
Mm-hmm. So, and when you think of Andy Vanya, he's a producer from the go-go 80s in my mind. He died at 74. He's Hungarian. And he just typifies the 80s along with Canon Films and others. You know, Carol Cole was just one of those hot properties. He and Mario Casar. And they just, you know, made everything and were making money and making deals and making money hand over fist. It was very exciting, I felt.
Right, and what I loved is he paid Warner Brothers more than $300,000 for the rights to a 1972 novel named First Blood.
And I have no idea why. What made him think that was such a hot property? They had to pay that much money for it. It's an obscure, not good best-selling book. Why that seemed about a Vietnam vet? Why they thought they had to pay that much money for that? I feel like Warner Brothers was probably laughing when they sold it to them for that amount of money. And then look what happened. They turned it into First Blood with Sylvester Stallone.
Well, maybe Stallone had read it and said, I want to make this movie. And, you know, Warner Brothers said, fine, but we
are off Rocky. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, you basically had Warner Brothers saying, yeah, but we already put $300,000 into, you know, optioning it, developing it. And, you know, we need to break even on it. So here, take it. Or take it in, by the way, we made some. You know, we made $150,000 because we bought it for, you know, 100, you know, who knows?
They bought it for 10 bucks, I'm sure. So it was a big gamble. It paid off hugely, of course, with First Blood and First Rambo, First Blood Part 2 and 3. Made him a hot property for a decade. And he and Mario Casar, they made movies like Angel Heart, Red Heat, Total Recall. On his own, he did Die Hard with a Vengeance and Evita. He helped reboot Hungary's film industry. He helped back the Oscar winner, Son of Saul, a terrific, devastating film that just won a few years ago. Unfortunately, in one of his lesser moments, he also backed the far-right Prime Minister Viktor Orban in Hungary, who has squashed dissent in that country, so that's unfortunate. But a classic, flashy, you know, overseas producer making deals on the fly, Andy Vanya sort of typified a certain era of Hollywood that's really kind of long gone.
Well, speaking of, you know, kind of eras that are long gone. Carol Channing, the star of Hello, Dolly. She died at the age of 97. Or as I'd like to say, I didn't even know she was alive.
Did you ever see her?
In person?
Yeah.
No, not in person.
Oh, well, I saw her on Broadway in a revival of Hello, Dolly, of course, back in 1995. She coasted through it delightfully. But, you know, she was a character, just a distinctive figure from beginning to end. She was in movies like Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and Thoroughly Modern Millie. She got an Oscar nomination for that, but she didn't get the Oscar nomination she wanted, and that was for Hello, Dolly. Of course, she was devastated when they bizarrely, foolishly, stupidly cast Barbara Streisand in the title role, dooming that film to failure. But she played Dolly like 8,000 times on Broadway and off. She famously missed only half a performance in Kalamazoo, Michigan because of food poisoning. She was on TV all over the place, from The Earliest of Days to Love Boat. She was Julie Tweez's, like, grandmother or godmother or something like that. I don't know. But she was all over the place. You could always know Carol Channing a mile away. She had four husbands, but I love this. Her last was Harry Koulijian. He was a childhood sweetheart, and they re-met 70 years later after they broke up. And they got married in 2003 and stayed together until he died in 2011, just days before his 92nd birthday. Now that's amazing.
We also have two additional people that we're going to talk about here. Dan, I don't know how to pronounce his last name. Stripeeky?
Yeah, Stripeeky. I don't know. I apologize to his family. I tried to find it online, but I failed. He's a key Emmy-winning and Oscar-nominated makeup artist. He died at 88. Terrific career. He was head of makeup at Fox when they won the only second Oscar available for makeup, and they won it for Planet of the Apes. He also worked in a lot of TV, and he helped design the famous pilaf latex mask from Mission Impossible. So in that show, when they would, you know, they'd be in disguise and they would pull off that latex mask and you realize it was, you know, one of our stars, that was something he helped work on. So that's very cool. He also worked on big movies like The Sound of Music, MASH, The Deer Hunter, My Favorite Year, Grease. But he's probably best known now for becoming the exclusive makeup consigliere to Tom Hanks starting in the late 80s. Forrest Gump, Saving Private Ryan, Joe versus the Volcano, all of them from right early in his career, right up until Dan retired after The Da Vinci Code. He did all of Tom Hanks' movies, and Tom Hanks was a very sweetheart, wrote a lovely note when he retired and won a Lifetime Achievement Award. And, you know, Dan sounds like a great guy, you know, a real classic Hollywood career.
Speaking of classical careers, we have a three-time Oscar-winning sound mixer, Greg Rudloff. He died at the age of 63. His dad, Tex Rudloff, worked on Taxi Driver and Clint Eastwood's The Outlaw Josie Wales. And so I guess Greg had a long collaboration with Clint, including Honky Tonk Man, which was his first credit, Flags of Our Fathers, American Sniper. He also did Rob Reiner's first four films, including
and
The Princess
Bride.
Films. Yeah, his best
his
films.
Her first four and best four movies, so Rob Reiner should have stuck with him.
Well, he won the Oscar for Glory, The Matrix, Mad Max, Fury Road, so three Oscars. He won Emmy for AIDS drama and Early Frost. He also worked on Risky Business and Footloose and Bachelor Party and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles and so many others. I mean, that's one of the things the sound mixers, they jump from film to film. They're constantly working.
And he's only 63, so sad loss, but what a great career.
Yes, it was a sad loss last week when we did not have a show, but hopefully you're feeling better, Michael, and we'll have a show next week. I'll be at Sundance, so we'll have to figure out how we're going to do that.
Oh, no. Are we not going to be able to record? Are you going to back off?
No, I'm going to try and do it.
All right. I will be available.
Well, you know what? If you want to make sure that we have a show next week, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can find our show there. Links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you can find those ways to subscribe to us. And by the way, please do rate and review us in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do. You can reach us via email, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. Or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. All of that information, again, on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They have their own website. It is whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found online, and every week he's got a new and exciting website for us. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's Can No Movie Win Best Picture?
Oh, kind of like No Host.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, if you can't find Michael there or any of his coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com to know what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.